After so many years in the theatrical wilderness, I don't want to risk losing my growing radio audience by dwelling on the sometimes tragic side of backstage life. Nevertheless, I believe it would be a crime to deprive you of the story of Colin and Magda because it demonstrates how kind and generous actions can sometimes pay handsome dividends many years later. Though, admittedly, not always to the original investors. Magda was a casting director secretary at Penn Park Studios in the early 50s. On the plump side and cosy-looking rather than pretty, she was very popular with out-of-work actors, for obvious reasons. My own interest in her waned when she told me it was only by marrying that a woman had a chance of fulfilling herself. One summer I went abroad with a dance troupe. I must tell you about that sometime. After I got home and had regained the use of my legs, I got the derisory part of a hotel receptionist's assistant in a picture at Penn Park. I called in at Magda's office to say hello, and I found a new girl in her place. She was amazed I hadn't heard the news of Magda's whirlwind romance and marriage. She pointed to some press pictures on the wall. There were lots of them. Bride and groom outside the church, arriving, leaving, huge crowds held back by police, bride and groom standing between film and TV personalities. And these pictures had been on the front pages of national newspapers. For the groom was none other than Colin Ward. That name may not ring many bells now, but at the time I'm talking about, Colin was a minor star in British films. He'd been in the RAF and had appeared in a documentary about safety in the air, and since he had good looks and enough sense to do exactly what the director told him without question, his debut was a great success. He was persuaded to take up film acting professionally. He did well. So, while I was crippling myself to music in the capitals of Europe, Magda met him, fell in love, and married him. Nothing amazing about that, but far from deserting the studios and becoming a model wife and mother, which is what I thought Magda had in mind when she'd spoken of fulfilling herself, she was never off the set, so long as it was the set Colin was working on. She literally took him over, pushed him up into a different bracket. I remember reading that she'd negotiated a Hollywood contract and that Colin would not be appearing in any more domestic productions. He loved England, she said, but he needed to go to America to reach the world market. She believed that he was all set to become another Gregory Peck or Cary Grant. One morning in January, when I'd just got back from the north of England, where I'd been playing the Sheriff of Nottingham in a panto which had run a week less than the scheduled four, I was lying in bed, to save putting on the electric fire, when the phone rang. "Jacko, it's Magda." Well, I recognised the voice at once, although it sounded weaker than I remembered it. "A voice from the past," she said. "How are things with you?" "Oh," I said, so-so, you know, ticking over. "You'll be wondering why I'm phoning." "Well, it's been a long time. Colin's doing well?" "Wonderfully. I'll come to the point, Jacko. Could you come over here and see me? I've something to discuss." I asked her what sort of thing she had in mind. "It would entail going to Hollywood." "Are you joking?" "No, I'm very serious. If you're free for 8 or 9 weeks, I'd like to talk to you about it." "Well, that's fine with me. Where are you at the moment?" "The Wigmore Street Clinic, 209 Wigmore Street." "Did you say clinic?" "I'm here for treatment." "How soon could you come over?" "Urgent, is it?" "Fairly." "I can walk and be there in an hour." "Fine. See you then." Click. Well, Hollywood. My heartbeats became audible. I told myself to calm down, but I couldn't. Had she really said Hollywood? Perhaps she'd said Holyrood and it was a remake of Bonnie Prince Charlie. No, she'd said she wasn't joking. The reception area was decorated and furnished in a style that made medical treatment look like gross self-indulgence. I was shown up to Magda's room immediately. I'm not sure what I expected, but it was certainly not a horizontal Magda who was too weak to sit up, pale and a good deal thinner than I remembered her. She gave me a very low-voltage smile and nodded towards the chair beside the bed. I mumbled something about not having had time to buy any grapes. Forget fruit. Forget flowers. Glancing around the room, I could see she had enough to start a business. I appreciate your coming. It was obviously an effort for her to speak. She was choosing her words carefully to conserve her energy. Colin has this Hollywood contract. He doesn't want to go, but he has to. I insist. The words came slowly in a whisper, but the substance was that Colin Ward had never been keen to go to America, and with Magda just getting over one operation and expecting to have another, he was dead against it. But this picture started shooting in 6 days. He had to go. It was not only the great career move, but the company would sue if the contract was broken. Then came the nitty-gritty. Magda wanted me to go with him as companion, stand-in, valet, nurse, what have you. It wasn't that she didn't trust Colin. It was just that she felt he was too diffident to stand up for himself and take on the problems she herself normally dealt with. She offered me $100 a week for 8 weeks with all expenses. I said I was on. Bless you, Jacko, she said. That's settled. I shall tell Colin when he comes in later.
You mean he doesn't know?
No, but it will be okay. I shall break it to him gently. Will you call back about 6 and meet him?
Of course.
Good. I'm feeling tired. I got up to go. Take some of these flowers, Jacko, and one of those baskets of fruit. I must have looked shocked. Please. Colin keeps sending them, and I shall only have to ask the nurse to take them away. Seeing she was in earnest, I picked up a basket piled high with peaches and grapes and a bouquet of roses still in the wash-basin for want of a vase. I felt a bit sheepish carrying out through the foyer what other people were carrying in, but the mental discomfort only lasted a few moments, and I was out in the street. I felt quite perky. I resolved to make the most of it. I spent the afternoon getting visa photographs taken and seeing Magda's travel agents. I chose a couple of lightweight Italian suits and some shirts from a smart shop in Duke Street and asked for them to be put aside until I called back to settle up. I figured that when I presented Magda or Colin with the bill, the reaction I got would be a good guide to how the phrase "all expenses paid" was to be interpreted. I needn't have worried. When I went round that evening, the second thing she said was that I should get kitted up in a style that would be a credit to Colin. He gave me a sort of man-to-man smile, and that was that. Seeing him in the flesh for the first time, I realized how really handsome he was. But although he was over 6 feet tall, he was not athletic. He had a slight stoop, and I remember wondering how his quiet charm would travel. The next few days passed very rapidly. I made friends with Mrs. Maynard, Magda's secretary, who was a great help in arranging the details of our trip, so by the time I locked up the flat and took the underground to Heathrow, I felt that things were really going my way at last. I was also in good health. I'd been on a fruit diet. It was an uneventful flight, and Colin mostly stared out of the window, now and again glancing at his watch. I guessed he was visualizing what Magda was doing and had her timetable more firmly in his mind than our own. In fact, he didn't change his watch to local time even after we arrived in America. We got a taxi and told the driver to take us to the Chateau Marmont, where Mrs. Maynard had made reservations. Well, the thrill of going to the place where Bogart had lived for so long was modified somewhat by Colin's depression. He stared out of the taxi window and moaned at every neon-lit building and architectural novelty. As we passed a fish and chip shop that had been modelled on a thatched English pub, he groaned loudly and bent forward until his face was in his lap.
"Is he okay, mister?" inquired the driver.
"He's fine," I said, "fine." And then, by way of explanation, "We've just got in from England." This seemed to satisfy him, for he remained silent until we reached the hotel entrance. A link man helped us with our luggage, and Colin followed him in. As I was paying the driver, he shook me by the hand.
"You see, I understand about Englishmen and their reserve. I had an Englishman in my cab once before. He was just the same. Name of Sir Ringo Starr. Have a nice day. Colin and I settled into this spacious suite. The first thing he did was close the connecting doors and phone Magda. Half an hour later, he came into my room and told me to pick up the phone. Magda sounded weaker than ever. I'm too tired to talk myself, Jacko, but Mrs. Maynard would tell you what I want to say. And with that, she handed the phone over. The message that Mrs. Maynard had to pass on was, briefly, get Colin to work. I must not allow him to walk through this job merely counting the days when he would be home again, Mrs. Maynard spelt it out. Magda's great wish is that he should make a success in Hollywood. She's praying for it. It is all she wants. I passed the message on. Colin merely nodded. Next morning we were up in good time and breakfasted in the coffee shop. As we were finishing, a man came over and introduced himself. He was middle-aged, had an English-type moustache, and was dressed in Ivy League style. It was Carl Wiener, and he worked in the press office at the studio. He was warm and friendly. "I was looking forward to meeting you, Colin. You too, Mr. Pratt, so I brought your car over. It'll be yours while you're with the company, but I thought you might like to drive over to the location and give you a chance to acclimatize yourselves. Let me say right away, I'm an Anglophile. Have been ever since I was over there during the war. Do you know Weymouth?" Of course we did. I had the happiest year of my life there. Never experienced such hospitality. Those wonderful English people just couldn't do enough for us GIs. Jews, blacks, whatever, it didn't make any difference. The people in that little town, and Poole and Swanage, they were the real creme de la creme. Carl carried on in this heartwarming style all the way to the location. A normally deserted spot in open country now transformed into a huge encampment of trucks and caravans. He took us to the enormous mobile dressing room set aside for Colin. It had armchairs, day bed, shower, fridge, telephone, cable TV, the lot. Chris Traub, the director, arrived. He was friendly but understandably anxious to get down to business. He outlined the first shot. It required Colin to run out of the bushes beside the road, look round for the girl playing the heroine, Denise Poulenc, never been heard of since, and then, after one line of dialogue, bundle her into the car and drive off. The one line of dialogue being, "Get in, we can talk on the way." Chris went over it with Colin in the dressing room and then took me to the location to do my stand-in bit for the lighting man. This took no time at all, and Chris called out, "Right, let's get this show on the road. Mr. Ward and Miss Poulenc, please." Well, of course, Colin was on the phone to Magda. The 60 or so technicians waited. No outward signs of impatience apart from a few brief eye contacts. Colin joined us, apologizing. And after being introduced to the crew and Miss Poulenc, he was checked for makeup and got into position. The cameraman gave the thumbs-up sign to the director. The clapper boy marked it and stepped aside. Chris shouted, "Action!" There was a pause. Nothing happened. Chris shouted again, louder this time. After another agonizing pause, he shouted, "Cut!" At that moment, Colin emerged from the bushes. "Sorry," he said. Just wasn't concentrating. "Okay," said Chris, "so it's Monday. Nevertheless, let's try and get this shot, shall we? Everything ready this time, Mr. Ward? Ready?" "Yes, ready," shouted Colin from the bushes. Chris shouted action, and Colin came out as arranged. He took the girl's arm very gently and led her towards the car. He opened the passenger door and stepped aside for her to get in. Chris shouted, "Cut!" "Listen," he said. "The girl has got into this situation because she disobeyed his instructions. Now he is trying to save her life and his own. He has no gun, and they're encircled by armed hoodlums. The car is their only chance, and they know it. We know the road is blocked at the pass. Let's try one more time." They shot it 18 times.
but there was no urgency, no pressure, no drama. Even when they'd got in the car, Colin was too gentle. He just couldn't seem to crash it into gear and streak off the way Chris wanted. He explained that making the wheels revolve before the car moved actually slowed up the getaway. This touched Chris on a raw nerve.
Truth, attention to detail, credibility, all these things I want. I love them like I love my mother, but most of all I want this movie to move.
Colin's response to this rhetoric was to look at his watch and ask if he could be excused to make a phone call. Chris nodded despondently, and off he went. I tried to explain Colin's devotion to his sick wife. I don't believe Chris even began to understand. A lunch break was called, and Chris spent it rewriting the scene. Later, they shot it without any problems, with the girl waiting in the car in the driver's seat. Colin merely had to come out of the bushes as fast as he could and join her. The girl drove off in the obligatory cloud of dust. Sighs of relief all round. Success. It didn't last long. The next shot had Colin and the girl lying in a ditch, hiding from their pursuers. They were supposed to make love while bullets ripped through the undergrowth around them. This was routine stuff to everyone on the set. But with Denise Poulenc belonging to what I call the Madame Tussaud school of acting and a completely wooden Colin Ward, it was more like a still session. Chris started to shake. After 4 days of this, a man with a briefcase drove up to the location. He went straight to Colin's dressing room, where Colin was inevitably on the phone to Magda. Work on the set came to a halt. Carl Wiener came over and whispered in my ear, "The axe man cometh. Care for a scotch?" No sooner had he spoken those words than the second assistant ran over to us. "It's a wrap," he shouted. "That's it for the day." "Oh dear," said Carl. Chris joined us. "We're recasting as of now. Sorry, Jacko. Head office." I got up to join Colin. I felt guilty about him being alone. "He's already left." "Colin left?" I said. "Where's he gone?" Chris shrugged. "He got in his car, streaked off. Just the way I wanted him to that first shot," he added bitterly. I was worried. Carl squeezed my arm. "I'll take you back." I said I wasn't worried about getting back. I just didn't like Colin being alone. Chris spoke his own thoughts. "I'm in a spot. I have to have another actor by 7 a.m. tomorrow." I wonder how many of my listeners will see this moment as my big chance. The oldest showbiz cliché of them all. Stand-in becomes a star overnight. I must admit I indulged in this unworthy thought for a moment or so. Then real life in the person of the second assistant replaced my fantasy. He hurried towards the car. He was ghostly white and out of breath. "He's dead," he said. "Died instantly. Hit a truck. A police patrol saw it happen." Everyone froze. "Colin?" I said eventually. "Colin?" The boy nodded and looked at Chris, then at Carl, then at me. Finally, he spoke again. "I shall remember his words as long as I live. His wife is on the phone." Nobody moved. Nobody spoke. I tried, but couldn't. Time passed. Eventually, I heard Carl's voice. "I'll have a word with her." He patted me on the shoulder and went towards the dressing room. I won't attempt to describe in detail what happened in the next few days. At first, there were rumours of suicide, but when it was shown that Colin was driving towards the airport, it was assumed he was trying to catch the next plane back to England and Magda, which I am sure he was. I spoke to her myself eventually after about 5 Californian brandies, but she was so heavily sedated I doubt if she recognised me. I stayed in my room at the Chateau Marmont in a state of shock. Carl phoned and gave me particulars of the cremation service arranged by the studio. We went to it together. It was a modest and cheap affair, attended by the two of us, a studio representative, and someone from the Screen Actors Guild. There's barely a mention in any of the newspapers. After the 5-minute ceremony, Carl surprised me by saying he had to rush away, but he made me promise not to leave L.A. for 48 hours. He wasn't quite his old self. He seemed mysterious, almost furtive. He phoned the morning of the day I was leaving and said he'd be over in an hour. Well, I thought, thanks to the good people of Weymouth all those years ago and the fact that I'm English, I seem to have a friend in Carl Wiener. I was feeling very low, as you can imagine, brooding about what I was going to say when I called on Magda. When Carl arrived, he was loaded with large envelopes and packages. He undid them and spread pictures and press cuttings all over the coffee table, the chairs, and finally the floor. I couldn't believe what I saw. After all, I had attended the perfunctory cremation ceremony, but the pictures Carl was displaying so proudly were of a spectacular funeral with a huge hearse and half a dozen cars piled high with floral tributes. There were lists of the people who'd sent them. Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, Ronald Reagan, and other showbiz personalities. There were photos of grieving crowds round the entrance to the Hollywood Memorial Park, a newspaper placard announcing "Star dies in dash to sickbed." There were fulsome obituaries, apparently, taken from the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Herald, etc. Collins' photo with captions like "British star destined for greatness," "Tragedy hits film colony." Finally, there was a beautifully mounted and framed photo of a marble memorial almost covered in wreaths, set in rolling pasture with one or two other impressive graves in the background. I looked at Carl. I didn't know what to say. He smiled. "The guys and gals in the press office have done quite a job, haven't they, with a little help from the printers and the props department? I wanted Magda to feel that we really appreciated Colin over here. I spoke to her doctor early this morning. I think you may just be in time to show them to her." I was very moved. Carl spoke brightly to save me embarrassment. "You see that?" he said, pointing to the marble memorial. "Tyrone Power is buried there. I took a liberty borrowing the flowers from props and having it photographed without permission from the family or anything, but Ty Power was a great gentleman, and he loved England and Europe just as much as I do. He would have approved of the deception in such a good cause, of that I am certain. If he knew, he'd be smiling approval." 24 hours later, I was showing the pictures and cuttings to Magda. She glowed. She squeezed my hand with amazing power. I wished Carl had been there to see her. For once, my timing was impeccable. She died that night. And so the debt that ex-sergeant Carl Wiener believed he owed to those kind and generous people on the south coast of England during World War II was repaid in Wigmore Street 15 or so years later. As for the balance the estate owed me, the solicitors haggled for 6 years, but I never got a penny.